playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. The health service slowly returned to what passes for normal this week after nurses and midwives went back to work on Tuesday. This followed intensive negotiations between their union, the HSE and government officials at the Labour Court to hammer out a deal to end the dispute over pay and conditions. But listening to nurses who rang Joe on the live line, not everybody was convinced.
Sheer anger. I work in a big Dublin teaching hospital. And they're all just saying, Australia, here we come. The young ones. The goodwill, probably, the general public will probably look on us as being greedy if we go back out again. But people are so angry now.
Mm-hmm. I was quite positive, actually, after reading it.
Okay.
And I have a lot of faith in Filney Hay, and I would wait until I get more information about it before I jump to any conclusions.
There will be an increase in allowance. When you apply for a mortgage, allowances are not considered at all. So after 7 years qualified with an honours degree from Trinity College Dublin, on my own, I cannot afford a one-bedroom apartment in Kildare or Meath, never mind Dublin.
We can't settle for second best. And I really strongly encourage the colleagues that are there today in the cold face of things to stand firm and say no to the ballot comes through. Had our management of the IMNO stayed firm, the executive, and stayed firm and allowed these 3 days, one consecutively after another, would really bring home the reality of the situation as regards the conditions that nurses and midwives are working in on a daily basis.
I'm so privileged to be allowed to look after the patients, and I just feel so disrespected. At birth, you have a nurse. At death, you have a nurse. And it's just so sad.
On Wednesday, the INMO recommended that members accept the Labour Court recommendations. But as always, the devil is in the detail. And union leader Filney Hay will be crisscrossing the country for the next few weeks, trying to sell what she says is a very complex set of recommendations to ensure that the deal flies. The issue was discussed on the gathering yesterday by journalists Richard Oakley and Brenda Power and politicians Catherine Noon and Pather Tobin.
The nurses' deal, Richie Oakley, did the government cave in?
Yes. First of all, everyone has great sympathy for the nurses. You know, there was emergency legislation brought in, their pay was cut and they wanted it restored in the same way as other public sector workers did. And they made that argument quite well. However, push that argument to one side and the next question is, there's a pot of money that the government has to run the country and can they afford to? And the government put down a line and said, no, we can't afford to give in to the nurses on this. The nurses held on to their strikes and the government then agreed a deal which, no matter what way you look at it, is a pay rise of 35 million. It's going to cost 35 million next year. You know, I'd imagine there was a huge groan in the offices of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council. We had this problem before during the boom years where the number of public sector workers increased dramatically, their pay increased. And when the bust happened, which was caused obviously by reckless lending in the banks, the money wasn't there. And we don't learn lessons. We just do the same thing over and over.
Senator Catherine Noon, government just storing up trouble.
I don't think so. You know, just to echo Richie's words there about the nurses, I think they are very valued in society and there was a huge sympathy for them across the board. And I think that what has been agreed is consistent with the public service agreement. I think that's to be welcomed. I think talk of some onslaught of all the other public services looking for pay increases, I don't think that that would be in keeping with that agreement. And I don't think it will happen. I don't think any of the rest of the public service would get the same sympathy, to be honest.
Brenda?
They wouldn't get the same sympathy, but that's not going to stop them now having a go. And you can't blame them.
They can have a go, all right.
You can't blame them. You know, I mean, when you hear stories about soldiers sleeping in their cars and so many of them on family income supports, then clearly there are public sector workers who are not being paid a living wage.
Well, that
basically is
an area that does need to be addressed.
You
know,
would
the
you blame
army,
them
definitely.
Then for piling in?
No, I wouldn't blame
and,
them.
And they have every imprimatur to do so now. Yeah, everybody has sympathy for the nurses, but I mean, a lot of the nurses' issues is not to do with pay, and I don't think that this pay increase will address the problems for the nurses. It won't address recruitment, it won't address retention, because the problem is the nurses are working in a broken, dysfunctional, incompetent health service.
Meanwhile, Health Minister Simon Harris had yet another challenging week of it. On Sunday, he and his wife and three-week-old baby daughter were trapped in their Wicklow home while anti-austerity protesters demonstrated outside. On Tuesday, he apologised to the Dáil and to Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan for holding back on the detail when questioned about the costs of the National Children's Hospital last September. And this set the scene for some straight talking when the Cabinet met.
OK, Cabinet. All right, let's have some order. First of all, it's been a difficult week for Minister Harris. Thank you. The Occupy Simon Harris movement behaved disgracefully. Yes. Being kidnapped by those povs and held hostage in that awful house. Was it?
Sorry, Taoiseach, I wasn't kidnapped.
What? I wasn't. What? You mean you went there willingly to, like, Greystones?
Well, yes, that's our house. That's where we actually live.
Seriously?
It's quite new. Cueva and I bought it when we were married.
OMG, that poor woman. We really aren't paying the nurses enough.
By the way, Si, dude, what's that thing that sticks onto it?
What do you mean?
The thing that was stuck onto your house. I couldn't make it out in the photos online.
It's actually another house.
What?
Yeah.
Like, why?
It's a semi-D.
A semi-what? Sounds like something Willie O'Dea gets when he thinks of his quota.
Semi-detached Smurfs, for goodness sake.
Right. FYI, I only do detached.
Yeah, detached from ordinary people, Lolcano.
I don't get it.
Others. Anyway, there was that, and there was no way I was going to give in to the nurses.
But you did, boss.
No, Minister Ring. We reached a compromise. Totes different thing.
What do you mean, a compromise?
Well, the nurses wanted to be able to pay their rent for a bunk bed next door to an illegal fly-tipping site. And not have to work 22-hour shifts. And we agreed that if they were only in that bunk 2 hours a day, that wouldn't be in line with our productivity expectation of that bed bunk. Yeah. So we've upped the productivity, which is a victory.
It still leaves us facing €100 million in cuts, though, to pay for the hospital.
Who said that?
Me. There he is.
Coveney, what are you doing here? I thought the only advantage of Brexit was that you'd be out of the country.
Wait, what are we going to do about the hospital, Taoiseach, now? Are we dodging?
Kate O'Connell, you're not even a minister.
I consider myself Minister for Defence of Simon Coveney when he's not here. Like, come on, now give us an answer. But I am here, Kate.
I didn't notice. Shite. Hello.
BTW, great news on the housing front. Taoiseach, we delivered 4,000 social homes last year. On target.
No, you're not. The Taoiseach promised 7,000.
And because we were 3,000 short, that left more cash to send to the hospital / money pit.
Yeah.
Has that cash been delivered, by the way, Lord Ross?
No, the cash is delayed, Prime Minister, due to traffic congestion in that area. Since I became the Secretary for Transport, all the omnibuses and trams are sold out night after night. What a success.
Oh, dear. Anyway, enough of all this. Where's my skinny chai latte with almond milk?
Oh, it's been rescheduled, dude.
Very funny, Merce.
Yeah.
Seriously, get my coffee now.
Ma'am, that's not even my job.
Reshuffle.
I'm on it right away,
boss. I'll get you back.
I'll leave you guys flying out among yourselves. Peace out.
From Callan's Kicks last night. Meanwhile, Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue was doorstepped by media about the spiralling cost of the Children's Hospital.
Minister.
First of all, I'm going to address you in my serious voice so you're not too overwhelmed by my cuteness.
Do you feel that Simon Harris misled you on the Children's Hospital overspend?
We prefer to say underestimation rather than overspend. After all, you can't overspend what you haven't got, and I only have a certain amount of money.
But did he mislead you before the budget, Minister?
Simon says he shared the figures with me as soon as it was possible to do so, and nobody enjoys Simon Says as much as I do.
Put your hands in the air.
What about how the overspend will cause €100 million worth of cuts to other projects?
No project 2040 Yogi Me Bobby will be cancelled, but there will be €100 million worth of reprofiling of capital projects.
What does reprofiling mean, Minister?
Well, it's like cuts, only it's a longer word. But we're not just calling it reprofiling.
What else are you calling it?
There will also be a few €1 million worth of upsie daisies in education,
what?
And the few million worth of odidums affecting the Department of Climate Change thingamajiggies.
But what sort of cuts will be imposed?
Cutsy wutsies.
What sort of cutsy wutsies will there be to the health service?
It won't be to anything you'd notice. Spleens, livers, lungs, those sort of things. Things that are in the inside that you can't actually see.
Is it time you apologise for the hospital fiasco?
You say fiasco, I say tomato.
Surely, as Minister for Finance, the buck stops with you.
I'm not the Minister for Finance. I'm a very naughty boy. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Thank you very much.
Oliver Callan and his motley crew giving the week a kicking. And then back in the real world at lunchtime yesterday, a dramatic development in the hospital saga.
Next to some breaking news on the News at One, the company tasked with building the National Children's Hospital has issued a statement this lunchtime. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham joins us now. Paul, this is unexpected. What does it say?
Well, the contractor you're talking about is BAM, and it has issued a statement which is something of a surprise. And it says that because of much commentary surrounding the tendering process, which it says is based on incomplete and inaccurate information, that it is prepared to withdraw from the project if the board responsible for it wants to re-tender. So in essence, it's actually offering to put a hold to the building, allowing the board of the hospital to send out a new tender which other companies could apply for. That's a dramatic development, certainly wasn't expected, and has really thrown the cat among the pigeons.
Claire Byrne with RTÉ's political correspondent Paul Cunningham on the News at One yesterday. Crime fiction writer Patricia Gibney worked as a county council worker in Mullingar for many years, but in the past three, she has sold over a million books and has been on bestseller lists in America, UK, Canada and Australia. She took up writing as a form of therapy after her husband Aidan died of cancer at the age of 49, leaving her to raise three young teenagers alone.
Yesterday, 10 years ago, he was diagnosed with cholangiocarcinoma. Cancer.
And were you with him when he was diagnosed?
Yeah.
And where was that? Is it in Mullingar?
In the Mullingar Hospital. I was working, ran over at lunchtime to bring him the paper, and the doctor said, I need to talk to you.
Did you have an inkling when he went into the hospital that there was something awful happening?
No.
No. So you went up with the paper, said, you'd be grand, I'll see you at dinner at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, and the doctor called me, oh, you're just the woman I need to see this to you. He just had the results back from a CT scan.
When you're told by somebody medical that I need to see the two of you together,
immediately
the clouds form.
Oh my God! It's just the cliche, the carpet and the rug is just pulled out from under you. Yeah.
Where did you go to meet the doctor?
He couldn't find a room. And I can remember this like it was yesterday.
Well, tell me about it.
And we were walking up and down the corridor, and he wasn't well. He'd lost a lot of weight, but he still didn't think that he was that ill. And eventually we'd walk halfway across the hospital to find a little, tiny little room with three or four little armchairs. And he was a lovely doctor, Dr. Murphy, and he was just so nice. And he just said, I have to tell you straight out, and that it's cancer. It was in his liver at that stage, but cholangiocarcinoma starts in the bile duct. And so it had metastasized into the liver. And the minute he said that, I said, oh, do a transplant, you know. And he said, no, I'm sorry, it's just gone too far. And I think, like we found out later, it actually had gone into a lot of organs at that time. Aidan just said nothing. I was doing the ranting and the raving and the hysterical bit, you know. I said, operate, you have to operate, you have to do something. And then I said, well, chemo. And he says, well, we have a very good consultant. He said, you can talk to him. And when I think back now, like between the lines, he was trying to tell us it was terminal, but he didn't say the words, you know. And you just grasp at everything. You just grasp at straws, and you know, you want to have some hope, you know. And Aidan then was very positive, and we did go for chemo, and he went for the chemo, and chemo was nearly worse than the disease itself. It was very, very tough, very hard on him. And like we had the three teenagers at the time, and the girls were doing junior cert and leaving cert, and college had started into
life,
secondary
life goes
school.
On, doesn't it? Life goes and, on, life doesn't go on.
You get into
on,
this yeah. bubble type of thing, you know, that you just have to, you have to get up every morning and live.
Patricia's openness really struck a chord with Ryan's listeners.
In a way, it took nearly 6 months to kind of hit in with me, because I'd been used to Aidan going on 6 months towards the duty abroad. Yeah. Like he had the year before, he'd been out in Chad and Congo, and like he'd gone to Lebanon, he'd been in, I can't even think of the names of the places, but he'd been abroad, like with the army. So I think it was nearly like 6 months afterwards when I realised the key wasn't never going to turn the door, that the army bag was never going to be thrown into the kitchen floor. You know, I think that's when it really hit me, you know. And even to this day, I was doing a decluttering at the weekend, and the top of the wardrobe, I still have all Aidan's uniforms. And like the last shirt that he wore still has the sleeves rolled up in the top of the wardrobe. That, you know, so it's just like, it comes to a time you think, well, nobody's ever going to wear that again. And there are the times that you kind of stop and say, this actually happened. You know, sometimes you can live in this little kind of a world that you go on and you go on, and then something will just stop you in your tracks. Like yesterday when I realised it was the 11th of February and it was the day he was diagnosed, you know.
What are you going to do with the uniforms?
I'm going to keep them.
I think you should.
Yeah.
Patricia Gibney with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday, and Patricia's latest book is a detective thriller called The Lost Child. When people go missing, it's a cause of great consternation for their loved ones and for their communities. And integral to finding them and bringing them home is a very special group of volunteers who patrol our rivers and waterways after the Coast Guard and rescue services have left. Brian O'Connell joined a team of volunteers who patrol the rivers in and around Cork City. He spoke with Dinny Kiley, who has very personal reasons for volunteering.
I know the river very well, just looking for mullet. Was fish for the mullet. But 1984, my aunt, she went into the river above by the Bridewell, and she was in there nearly 3 months. It was normal at that time, like, look, and I was fishing all the time. I was hoping I didn't come across her because I was so young, you know.
What age were you?
I was 18, about 18.
Were you close to her?
I was. She was really nice. We called the boat after her there, the Nora Flynn. This would be my 17th year now, Annis.
17 years you've been doing this?
17 years, yeah.
Are you busier now than you were when you think back 17 years ago?
Oh, way busier, way busier.
And do families ever come and ask you questions after?
They're always held during the search.
Okay.
They kind of disappear afterwards, as you can imagine, like, you know. But they're always held during the search, and we try to coax them to go home. Because I think it's a terrible thing watching someone looking into the water, knowing that their family is in there. You know?
And I suppose for you, because you had personal experience, it means a huge amount for a family to have a body to bury.
Big time, big time. I mean, you can imagine coming down here, a family, if they didn't get their family member back, and they're looking, they're saying he's in there somewhere, you know. It's terrible. It's they're looking into the abyss. Mm-hmm. When they're looking into the water, they're just staring, they're hypnotised. And I don't know, it's a terrible sight, like.
Brian O'Connell reporting for the Today Show on Tuesday. Dublin's Lord Mayor Neil Ring made the headlines this week when he apprehended an alleged burglar. Well, Mary Wilson spoke with the Have A Go hero on Drive Time.
Certainly not in your job description, but what happened?
Well, what happened, Mary, I was coming from City Hall and there was a man chasing a young guy or a youth. He was shouting at him, so it was obviously something had happened. So I asked my driver, I was in the Lord Mayor's car, to go down to the other end of the street, and I hopped out to sort of cut him off or intercept him. And so by the time he got down to where I was, he had sort of run out of steam. So myself and the other chap had been chasing him, and another guy came out in the apartment block. We just surrounded him and he sort of gave up. Whether he realised I was the Lord Mayor and had superpowers of arrest, I don't know.
Had your chains of office on?
I hadn't, but they were in the car, and if the guards hadn't arrived within about 20 seconds, I was ready to chain them to the railings with them, Mary. But there was no need to do that. The guards actually did arrive literally within 20 seconds and took over, and we just left. And I'd like to commend the two lads who actually helped me and try, and hopefully they'll contact your show and maybe I can have them into the Mansion House just to thank them for doing their civic duty. Mm. You know, it was brave because they didn't know whether he had any weapons, etc. And, you know, I put my action down to just instinct that it's the right thing to do.
Was it just instinct? You know, you have to handle yourself, are you?
I'm 6'2" and I'll give a big plug to the park runs. I do them every Saturday morning, so I'd be fit enough. So I knew I'd be able to tackle this guy if necessary. You know, I think of my elderly mother. You know, if someone assaulted her, of course you'd hope someone would intervene. If someone tries to break into a house, you'd hope someone would intervene. I know the guards may say, look, you know, leave it to them. Now, they were there and they have to really commend them as well. They were fabulous.
Lord Mayor Neil Ring is heard on Drive Time with Mary Wilson. Well, if you're a big fan of traditional music, chances are you'll be heading to Belfast for the T.G. Cahir Grotham Keogh Awards tomorrow night, where flute player Catherine McAvoy will be presented with the Musician of the Year Award. Catherine was born and raised in Birmingham to Irish parents and spent many summers here before moving over permanently in 1976. She was Aoife Ní Cormac's guest on The Rolling Wave, and as she told Aoife, the flute wasn't actually her first instrument. She began with the piano accordion.
I met Kathleen Lowry again and I asked her if she wouldn't mind teaching me the piano accordion, because we actually had one in the house. My mother had actually bought one for my brother John, who's a fiddle player, yeah, for Christmas. And so she said she would. But meanwhile, I had tried to learn a few tunes myself. But being left-handed, I didn't realise that the accordion was upside down. So when I went for my first lesson, I was actually playing the pigeon on the gate, you know, the reel, the pigeon on the gate. And Kathleen said, oh, that's lovely. But the accordion is upside down. So, of course, I had to start all over again. So, so that was it. Started on the accordion. And then, of course, I was listening to, came across Finn Baudoir and Joe Burke and, you know, people like that. And I ended up going to the Flan Listowel. And I think, dare I say it, I won the under 11 piano accordion in the year dot.
And did you stop there or did you continue?
No, I carried on until I was about, I'd say, 15. And it was at that stage that I came across Josie and Peg McGrath.
T.G. Carr Musician of the Year, flute player Catherine McAvoy with Felix Dolan on piano, as heard on The Rolling Wave with Aoife Ní Cormac, Sunday nights at 9, here on RTÉ Radio 1. As you walk towards Smithfield in Dublin's north inner city, the area around North King Street and Henrietta Street is redolent with history. Number 14 is a former Georgian townhouse turned tenement and now fully restored by Dublin City Council. Social historian Donal Fallon gave us the backstory on Monday's Ryan Tuberty show.
I think Henrietta Street is marvellous because more than any street in Dublin, it embodies for me the rise and then the decline of Dublin. I mean, it's the first Georgian terrace street in Dublin laid out in the 1720s. And that's a time when Dublin is the second city of the British Empire, or at least she thinks she's the second city of the British Empire, and she refers to herself as such. And you have this Georgian city of great wealth and great vision. Luke Gardner, the man who lays it all out, a property developer and a politician. What a combination. And then, come the 19th century, it's remarkable how this is transformed. And a street where, you know, families had lived on their own in one house in great wealth and privilege becomes this subdivided street of tenements. And by 1911, by the time of the census in 1911, 835 people are living in 15 homes on that street. So how does that happen? You know, how do you go from such wealth in the days of Gardner to such poverty in the Victorian age? It's just a remarkable story. And there's comic villains in this story. Really? In our case, Thomas Vance, he's a landlord. He buys a number of these houses and he just subdivides them and subdivides them and subdivides them. Take out the staircases, take out the fireplaces and sell them at auction. Cut and cut and cut. And suddenly you have a house built for one family now containing 19 flats in the case of 14.
So you could have 100 people living in one house that housed a family of five.
Extraordinary. And the layers of class here were very real. I mean, Ernie O'Malley had a great line. He said, in Ireland, the layers of class are more than the layers of an onion. And they kind of are, you know, tuppence and a halfpenny looks down on tuppence. And when you look at who was living in 14 Henrietta Street in the census, there's, you know, there's general labourers who are people that do any work that's going. Sure. But there's also people like milliners, French polishers, bookbinders. You know, there's all human life in these houses. Yeah. And that's the misconception that everyone who lived in a tenement was totally poor, totally broke.
Yeah, strumpet city sort of thing.
In reality, there was layers of class even within these buildings.
Well, Peter Branigan was born in the basement of number 14 Henrietta Street in the summer of 1939. There were 13 in his family. His mother slept in one straw bed with his five sisters. His father slept with the six lads in another. And as Peter says, they were a very close family. They'd no choice but to get on.
We shared toilets by all the people in the house down the back.
It could be 100 people.
Yep. No soft tissue then.
So, when you think of it, yeah.
You know, so they're only cleaned twice a week, Monday and Friday.
Crikey, yeah.
So you never went down in the dark because those houses were pitch black. There was no electric light or gas light in the hallway or stairways.
Yeah.
Between a family there, they use a bucket.
A bucket in
boys
your room.
And girls.
If you did venture down to the toilet, would it have been a pretty unpleasant experience?
Absolutely.
At night time?
Absolutely. It would.
You wouldn't be on your own.
All these buildings, they had rats, plenty of rats there.
As well?
Yeah. You'll find them around the sink, late in the evening and very early in the morning.
Would you hear them even if you weren't seeing them?
You'll always tip your bucket off the wall before you went down with your water.
So no running water, obviously no electricity, no heating. What did you do for light, for example?
Well, down in the basement, we hadn't even the luxury of the gas light. It was candlelight and oil lamp. That's what we had, and they were on all day long. Our cooking was done on an open fire in the room. Yeah, okay. And down the space.
And bucket, though. The bucket is one of those artefacts that when people come into the place, especially young people, they can't get their head around the idea that there wasn't a toilet in every floor, never mind in every tenement. And there's other things like the Reckitt's blue paint and the Rattle Red, that if people had any experience of these blocks, instantly they bring everything right back. And also the religious iconography, especially in the case of your family. Religious iconography in
everywhere.
Every home,
absolutely.
Peter Branigan and Donal Fallon heard on The Ryan Doherty Show on Monday. Brexit. Only 41 days to go. And further chaos this week as British Prime Minister Theresa May lost yet another vote in the House of Commons on Thursday night. Earlier in the week, Bertie Ahern, one of the authors of the Good Friday Agreement, was invited before a House of Commons committee to give his tuppence worth.
Allow the right honourable gentleman from Upton Snodsbury.
What say you, Irish, just be good fellows and rejoin the United Kingdom?
We've had 800 years of difficulties between us since the Norman Wise invasion. But I think I'll just be kind and ask which part of off you didn't understand.
You see, there always will be a place for Paddy in the Empire, helping one onto one's horse, allowing one to put one's feet up after a long day on his back, doing a funny drunken dance in the corner for turnips and such. We miss you, Paddy, and that is the truth of it.
Well, if I can quote your man Mel Gibbons here, we can take your Strictly Come Dancing and your tracker bars, but you can never take our freedom.
The right honourable gentleman from East Antrim.
Yeah. How are you, Sammy Sausages?
You have come here today with the foul stench of Republican Sinn Féin, IRA, murder gang, chitty chitty gangbang falling from your flayed nostrils. What? Your cloven hooves dancing on the roofs of Westminster as you beat the war drums of hell.
Cool the jet. Save your breath to fool your porridge.
The Prime Minister of the self-declared Republic of the Bit under Northern Ireland, Mr. Leo Marauder, has used dangerous, devilish rhetoric.
Order.
Do not make eye contact with this man.
Order.
Do not play cards with this papist demon.
That wouldn't be much use anyway. I have no cash on me.
Order. Page roll. Thank you, Mr. Ahern.
Anyway, can I cash in me receipts now? I'll take sterling or dollars.
From Callan's Kicks last night, Brexit. Hard border, soft border. In his new book, The Border, The Legacy of a Century of Anglo-Irish Politics, historian Diarmaid Ferriter charts the history of this 500-kilometre meandering and porous line with 208 crossings. He spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
It is now, as we know, an invisible border by and large. People come and go for work, for trade, for whatever. That is now, within the next 45 days, set to begin to change greatly. What do you think is feasible?
What's feasible? Northern Ireland needs to have special arrangements. And I say that with the weight of a century of Anglo-Irish history behind the assertion. Northern Ireland has always been treated differently in the United Kingdom because of the particular circumstances of Ireland and because solutions needed to be devised that acknowledged and recognised the divisions in Ireland. In the context of Brexit, Northern Ireland still needs a solution. We've been talking, of course, about the backstop, which is one form of that solution. And obviously the DUP have set their minds very much against that. But when you trace back through the decades, there have always had to be particular solutions for Northern Ireland. And Brexit is no different. One of the interesting things about the complications arising out of Brexit, of course, is also that it is drawing attention to the question of whether the British government is, in the words of the Good Friday Agreement, rigorously impartial in relation to Northern Ireland, because that is one of the requirements under the Good Friday Agreement. Has Brexit compromised that sense of a British government that is rigorously impartial? And again, you can see the continuities, because a lot of the focus 100 years ago was on the idea that Ireland was being used as a pawn in English politics, in what was a distinctly English power game. And you could argue the same is going on now in relation to the DUP and the Brexiteers. Ireland is something of a pawn, but there's still far too much ignorance about it. And if more knowledge existed about Northern Ireland, they would recognise...
Well, it just didn't feature in the debate, did it?
But isn't that the dark irony? That what didn't feature in the debate has become the biggest stumbling block. And there's a lesson in that about an almost willful ignorance that we will not engage with our Irish question. The imperative was always to get it off the table of Downing Street. David Lloyd George famously boasted that he had got rid of the Irish question with partition and the Anglo-Irish Agreement. He hadn't got rid of the Irish question. He'd put it into storage. But it comes out of storage, and it's come out of storage very aggressively in the context of Brexit.
Historian Diarmaid Farriter, author of The Border, The Legacy of a Century of Anglo-Irish Politics, heard on The Today Show on Tuesday. The England-Ireland question was also a hot topic in the sporting world this week, and there was general wailing and gnashing of teeth among soccer fans here when news broke that Declan Rice won't be playing for Ireland again. Yes, he's changed his mind and is hitching his star to the England team. Eamon Dunphy wasn't at all surprised.
How big a blow is this to the Ireland international setup?
It's a massive blow. He's a great player. He just turned 20, but he's a brilliant player. He's great temperament. He's playing in the West Ham team, which isn't the best team in the Premier League by any means, but he's assured he can play centre-half in the back four. He can play in midfield. He's playing in midfield now. He's a mighty talent. It's a bad blow.
The heading on your piece this morning in the Star, Declan Exit, is a legacy of the O'Neill era. Why do you say that?
Why, no. He was in camp when Roy Keane had a very heated argument with John Walters and Harry Arthur last summer. He was questioning why they were on the treatment table so often. And Rice was in camp, and my understanding is he may have witnessed this. The players were shocked in the squad. And there were other incidents involving Keane in particular, criticising players, intemperate language, arguing with a fan, you know, all of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, but that all ended, and Keane and Martin O'Neill moved on, and then Mick McCarthy came in, and he, by all accounts, tried to love bomb Declan.
Well, I don't think it's a question of love bombing or not. It's a question of being professional. I've talked to players who've been in the camp or were in the camp with O'Neill and Keane, and it was a shambles. The training session, the tension that was in the air, the sort of menace that was around, I think that was a part of his decision. I wouldn't say it was the only factor. For his career as an England international, I think he'll be in the England team very shortly, because he's a better player than the players who are in that position in the team now. And, you know, he is English born, so he's made a decision that he's entitled to make, and I think it's disgraceful what's being said about him. Former players, Kevin Kilbane, for example, you know, who made the decision to play for Ireland. But Kevin Kilbane was never going to play for England anyway. This young man has made the right decision. It's clearly been a tough decision, and we should wish him well, as Mick McCarthy has done.
Eamon Dunphy telling it like it is on The Today Show. George Loudon was only 10 years old when he made his first guitar, using wood from his father's boatyard and with fishing line for strings. He's 67 now, and his clients include Eric Clapton, Paul Brady and Bruce Springsteen. His firm, Loudon Guitars, is based in Downpatrick, and Ed Sheeran has teamed up with him to make quality, affordable guitars, and the idea is to encourage young people to play music. George Loudon dropped into the Ray D'Arcy studio on Tuesday.
How many guitars have you made in 45 years?
Well, the Loudon Guitars is about 23,000 now, plus about 5,000 made in Japan.
Right.
And then for the Ed Sheeran, of course, the first ones are coming out in March.
Do you watch a concert, and have you ever been surprised at somebody arriving on stage with a Loudon when you didn't expect it?
I don't go to too many concerts.
No, but even on the telly.
But even on the telly, yes. I mean, one thing happened, for example, not at a concert, but I was contacted by a guitar maker in America last year. And he said to me, I've got a guitar here, one of your guitars here, and it's owned by the boss. We all know who the boss is. And I didn't know that. I had no idea that he had one. But he said that the bridge has popped off after X number of years or whatever. So he was asking me for a bridge so that he could repair it. So you do get surprises like that. And Bob Dylan was another one. I found out that he had got hold of one some way or other. And, you know, so, yeah, you do get surprises.
These people, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Bob, how many guitars would they have?
They would have a large collection. A large collection, yeah. Although it's nice for me to hear that they have one. It's even nicer if I happen to see them playing one on stage. Or recording with one. My guitars are used a lot for recording.
They would have had to buy that. You wouldn't have given them.
Oh, yes. They definitely would have to buy that. We don't give away guitars, although we do. Young players, very young players who have got a lot of talent, we try to give them a really good deal, you know, as best we can to help.
Encourage them. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Does the Edge play any Loudon guitars?
Yes, he does, actually. Yeah, he has one of my classical guitars, one of my personal classical guitars.
Yeah. Did he commission that, or did you?
He commissioned that. Yeah.
Right.
That was a lot of years ago now.
Isn't that nice? What do you pay? The Edge here? Is that how it went?
I remember I was so excited I delivered it to his.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. To the offices there.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Tuesday. Paul McKenna is known throughout the world as a self-help guru to the stars and other mortals. And his books, I Can Make You Thin, I Can Make You Happy, I Can Make You Rich, I Can Make You Confident, I Can Mend Your Broken Heart, have sold millions of copies. Ahead of his live show in Dublin in a fortnight, he dropped into Ryan Tubridy's studio yesterday.
Can I ask you about one thing, about the fact that you've sold more than 10 million copies of your books?
Yes.
And the fact that your English teacher at school had kind of predicted a different future for you in terms of your literary endeavours. What did that English teacher say?
Well, actually, it was one of my school reports said, I would never amount to anything. And so when I had my first number one bestseller, I wrote something rather rude in it and sent
you
it to...
You wrote... You.
Yes, that's right, F something you.
Yes.
And anyway, it was very childish, but God, it felt good.
Gratifying, was it?
Oh, it's lovely.
It just felt good, didn't it? Just to say to you, I mean, it's a real put down for somebody, for a child to be told that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nowadays, I don't know if it's still the same, but it's very draconian when I went to school. And a lot of things that are now considered child abuse were standard daily practice. And, you know, it's very interesting. Some people get crushed by something like that.
Yes.
Yeah? I'm the sort of person that I go, right, I'll show you. And I had this conversation, actually, with Tony Robbins a couple of years ago. And we were saying, why is it that some people get crushed? And some people go, they're right, I'm going to rise to the challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of that could be environmental. Some of it may be genetic. I mean, again, the jury's kind of out on that one.
Hypnotist Paul McKenna with Ryan Tubridy yesterday. It's all about the environment these days, and the popular novelist Sinead Moriarty has decided to take direct action in her campaign to reduce waste. So when she goes shopping, she simply unwraps the plastic at the supermarket till and leaves it behind on the counter. Evelyn O'Rourke caught up with her to see how easy or not it is to do this.
So I took a deep breath. It's a bit awkward when you stand at the counter and people are behind you and you start unwrapping your bananas and your peppers. But I have to say that the guy in the checkout was really nice about it. I said, look, I'm sorry about this. Very Irish, apologised, obviously, first. He completely agreed with me and I asked him if many people do it. And he said, not that many, but more should. And, you know, bananas do not need to be covered in plastic, nor do apples, nor do peppers, nor do so many things in the supermarket. Because, I mean, Ireland was amazing. We were one of the leaders in charging for plastic bags. So let's try and stop the overuse of plastic packaging. Since I've done my last few shops in different places, they're very, very open to taking it back and very nice about it. So please, please, please consider taking off unnecessary plastic and leaving it at the counter.
We're walking down one of the aisles here, for example. We've got all the crackers and stuff in front of us. I mean, everything has to come in some sort of a container.
Obviously, for the sake of hygiene, things need to be packaged. Does it need to be plastic? And also, the other thing I think people really need to think about, again, I'm new to this and I'm trying my best, is to stop buying takeout coffee cups. What a reusable coffee cup. And in the last 3 weeks, I've probably saved 15 throwaway ones. And that's just me on my own. And it's little things, you know. You might not want to take out 12 toilet rolls, but you can certainly take out 2 rolls of kitchen towel and leave the packaging behind. And look, I did feel awkward the first time I did it, but actually I don't anymore. So just get over the first time and you'll be fine about it.
Novelist Sinead Moriarty with Evelyn O'Rourke, heard on the Today Show on Thursday. Well, as you know, insects are a vital part of the ecosystem, providing food for birds and small mammals and helping to pollinate crops and replenish soils. However, a major global scientific study has warned that insects are dying at a catastrophic rate. Professor Yvonne Buckley of Trinity College Dublin explained why when she spoke with Claire Byrne on the News at One.
Well, insects are one of the bases of the terrestrial food webs. So insects are eaten by birds and bats and mammals. They decompose leaves, for example, so we'd be up to our necks in undecomposed litter without insects. They disperse seeds. They keep the whole ecosystem going. They're basically the little engineers that run around unseen and fix everything, do everything to keep the ecosystems working, provide our food, provide nature, provide health benefits to us.
So ultimately, could this lead to impacts on clean air and water?
Absolutely. Yeah. So insects do a lot of processing of nutrients in water systems and in the soil. For example, they keep the nitrogen flowing around ecosystems, and they provide pollination services in particular for crops. So without insects, we would be missing out on a lot of seeds and fruits that form part of our normal daily diet.
What can be done now to halt the decline?
I think a lot can still be done. So the major cause of decline is habitat loss. So this is where we're removing hedgerows, we're intensifying grassland. We need more flowers, more native species, more native trees and shrubs back in our landscapes. And we need to stop removing those elements from our landscapes. So the intensification of agriculture and the use of pesticides has also been implicated in these insect declines, as well as urbanisation.
So all of this feeds into climate change, doesn't it? And measures that some would say we have not put in place to deal with climate change, that piles on the pressure, this study today, to act, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the major determinants of the insect declines to date haven't been climate change. But when you add in climate change on top of habitat loss and pollution, it's really going to possibly be the last straw for insect populations. Particularly in the tropics, insect populations there are starting to feel the brunt of climate change. It hasn't hit us here in Ireland quite as severely yet, but there's things we can do in our own backyards and in farms already today that will help to make our insect populations more resilient to climate change that's happening over the next few decades.
Okay, can you share any quick tips for people who would like to do something?
So don't cut your lawns until a little bit later in the season. Let the dandelions and clovers come out and provide really important early season pollen and nectar for bumblebees in particular. Don't cut your hedgerows. Let them flower. Plant some native species in your garden. No matter how small your garden is, you can always put in something for the bees and the butterflies.
Professor Yvonne Buckley of the Zoology Department at Trinity College with Claire Byrne on the News at One last Monday. But I'll leave you now with music from the band Eurodney, an 8-piece ensemble featuring musicians from across Europe, including Irish violinist Cora Venus Lunny. They played live on Wednesday night's arena. Gurumaga Vaswar Golluder, Tasulambur Wanshev, Saltasaglar, Agus Kameshev Lum, Taka Anamakena, Antachthan Chahogin, Gajishin, Gajeshab Slan.